I just didn't think anyone would go after you. He and Decker were walking together down the hall of the hospital. It's okay, said Decker. I'm good to go. So it was Roy Mars. Decker nodded. I think we can safely say that, although I'd like to know his real name.
Wouldn't we all?
They left the hospital, got in Bogart's car, and drove off. Bogart glanced at Decker as they hit the main road.
How are you feeling?
Stupid and slow. So my status hasn't changed since we got on this case.
I mean, physically.
It hurts, but I've felt worse. A lot worse. Look, we need to get all the arrest records for Charles Montgomery.
We have the major ones, the ones that led to his execution.
I want the minor ones, the ones where he skipped bail. We have some of those details, but I need it all.
You think that's important?
We have to trace the connection between Roy Mars and Montgomery. It wasn't random, which means it's important. If we can find that connection, we may discover who's behind this. We get that, then the whole thing starts to unravel.
But maybe it has something to do with the murders that Montgomery was convicted of.
No, those were fairly recent. Whatever the connection with Roy Mars, I believe it goes back 40 years or more.
That may be true, conceded Bogart. But that long ago, finding detailed records will be very difficult.
Montgomery got back from Vietnam in 1967. He mustered out of the army shortly thereafter. Then he was involved in a series of petty crimes.
But he told us he was having headaches, messed up from the war. Maybe he was rebelling. He was young and stupid.
Did Montgomery strike you as stupid?
No, but he was a lot older, more hardened when we met with him. A young punk back then, he was probably capable of anything.
I think the guy we saw hadn't changed much from when he was young. He fought in Vietnam and was wounded. He was no punk. He was a soldier who'd been through hell and back. And there's something else, too.
What? Said Bogart quickly.
I'm having trouble pulling it out.
What, your brain going wacky on you?
My brain is wacky, all the time.
I meant, is it starting to work like the minds of the rest of us poor schmucks?
It was something, said Decker, ignoring Bogart's comment. Something I saw or heard.
He touched the bruise on the side of his head.
Maybe Roy hit me harder than I thought.
You'll think of it. In the meantime, I'll dig up as much detail as I can on Charles Montgomery.
They drove on.
Later that evening, Mary Oliver met them all for dinner at a restaurant a few blocks from the motel.
Milligan looked at Decker's face and said,
Damn, I think you're lucky he didn't crack your skull.
He probably wanted to, said Decker. But if he wanted me dead, he could have just slit my throat.
Mars put down the knife he was holding to cut his salad.
Sorry, Melvin, said Decker, noting this.
Hey, it is what it is. My old man's nuts.
No, he knows exactly what he's doing and why. He understands that him getting you out of jail caused these folks to come after you. They want what was in the safe deposit box.
So he has those contents?
Asked Oliver.
Probably, said Decker. I mean, not on him, but somewhere. Somewhere safe that only he knows.
Oliver said,
If we could find him, he could take us to it. Then we could go after whoever's implicated by those contents. They must have been the ones who took Lisa.
Milligan added, Well, that's easier said than done. We went over Decker's room and didn't find one usable print or shoe mark. The guy's a pro. No one saw him come, and no one saw him go, and the lock was expertly picked.
He is a pro, said Decker, and he knows who's after him, and he knows what they want.
But how do we find him?
Asked Oliver.
There must be some way.
He's been watching us. He knows about us, knows we're the FBI. He knows we're investigating all of this. I think he must be close by.
Milligan said, If he is, we should be able to find him. We have a description, and the town's not that big.
But he also likely knows every bit of this place,
pointed out Jameson.
And there are probably lots of abandoned houses and farms in the area where he could be staying.
Decker looked at her oddly. That's true.
That he knows lots of abandoned places to stay?
That he might know one abandoned place to stay.
You don't mean my old house, said Mars.
Why not?
is too obvious, for one.
So obvious no one's checked it, said Decker.
But you were there,
pointed out Jameson.
And we later went with you and Melvin.
But no one's watching it all the time, said Decker. No one's watching it right now. And if he wanted to hide the contents of that box?
Oliver said.
You think it might be somewhere there?
There's no guarantee, but it might be worth a look. He glanced at Mars. Can you think of any location there that might be a good hiding place?
Oliver pulled her phone out of her pocket and looked at the screen.
This is about Melvin's lawsuit.
She typed in a response and smiled at Mars.
Things are looking up, Melvin. I've got a friend in the state government. She just let me know that the state correctional system got my motion on your punitive claim, and apparently the whole department is in an uproar, running around like chickens with their heads cut off. That means they know they're vulnerable, and that also means they might come to the settlement table sooner rather than later.
Well, ain't that a miracle, said Mars.
I think public opinion is on your side now.
Decker said, that is good news, but let's not lose focus. Melvin, can you think of any place in the house it could be?
Mars said, I can't think of anything off the top of my head. The house ain't that big, and I never had cause to hide anything.
How about in the garage?
Well, there was a loose board in the wall next to the door leading from the kitchen. I remember I looked in there once when I was a kid, saw an old coffee can. It didn't mean anything to me, and I doubt my dad was hiding an old coffee can.
Well, it's worth a look. Melvin and I can go check it out later tonight.
Bogart said, Todd can go with you just in case. I'm expecting to get in some information on Montgomery shortly. Alex, Mary, and I can go over it while you guys are checking out the house.
Sounds like a plan, said Mars.
Chapter 53. Milligan led the way through the mass of trees and bushes in the front of the property, with Decker and Mars close behind. The rain had stopped, at least for a bit, but the clouds were heavy with moisture, and they all expected another dousing at any moment. They reached the front porch, and Milligan eased the door open, his hand on the butt of his gun. Decker was doing likewise. They entered the front room and looked around. It was dark outside, but darker still in here. Milligan swept his flashlight beam around the space. Decker led them into the kitchen with his flashlight, and then to the door going into the attached single-car garage. He aimed his light around the space, while Milligan did likewise.
It's over there, said Mars, pointing at a section of the wall near the side door leading to the outside. You could see where the wood is uneven.
They headed to that spot, following Milligan's flashlight beam. Decker gripped the board and pulled on it. It came away easily enough. Revealed behind it was a small compartment, really just a space between the wall studs. It was 6 inches deep and about 18 inches wide. The floor of the compartment was a crossbeam of wood connecting the studs. It was empty.
It could have been the hiding place, pointed out Decker. It's probably large enough for whatever was in the safe deposit box.
But it's not here, said Milligan. So that doesn't help us.
He aimed his light around some more and then cast it on the floor. It was clean except for what looked to be fine dust and a small strip of wood.
Probably happened when you pulled the wood out, he said.
I checked the floor before I pulled the wood out. That pile of dust and wood chips was already there. And if you look at the board, it has a strip of wood out of it that corresponds to the one on the floor. When I pulled on it, it came out way too easily. Place like this, abandoned for decades with rot and moisture, I'd expected the wood to be far more difficult to get out. I think it was in that state, and the wood strip broke off when it was forced out.
Which means that someone else was already here, said Milligan.
Decker nodded.
And recently, because we searched this place before, and I don't remember seeing the strip of wood, and I would have if it had been there.
Mars said excitedly, So you think my old man did hide the stuff in there?
I can't say for sure either way, replied Decker. But someone checked it for some reason. Maybe him, or someone else.
He looked around. And by the way, the initials of your dad's real name are A and C.
How the hell do you know that?
It's carved in the closet and also matches the ones he used when he rented the car in Alabama. Arthur Crandall?
Milligan tensed and gripped Decker's arm. I think someone just entered the house through the back door. They all stood stock still, listening.
There, said Milligan.
That was definitely footsteps, said Mars.
Yes, agreed Decker. He eyed the overhead garage door. Do we go out that way?
Milligan said, I bet that door hasn't been opened in 20 years. We try to, it'll make a noise like a train going off the rails. Probably the same for the door over there. And we saw earlier that bushes and shit have grown up right in front of those entrances. We'd be tangled up in sitting ducks.
But they must know we're already in the house, said Mars.
Not necessarily. Not if they came through the back, countered Milligan. And even if they do know we're here, they may not know we're in the garage.
You don't think it's Bogart? Asked Mars.
He would have called, said Decker. He's not sneaking in here when he knows we're here. There might be an unpleasant result.
Right, said Milligan.
Then who is it? Asked Mars.
Decker and Milligan drew their guns at the same time.
Get behind us, Melvin, said Decker.
Hey, I can take care of myself.
Not with people with guns, you can't, pointed out Milligan.
Decker punched in numbers on his phone. He looked at the screen.
It's not going through. No bars.
Still the middle of nowhere out here, said Mars, even 20 years later.
Milligan squared his shoulders.
Okay, do we wait here and let them come through the door?
Good firing line, and we could probably take them out if they make a run at us.
That sounds like a good strategy to me, said Decker. But we need to split up. I'll take that corner, Todd, and you can take the other one. That way they'll have 2 fields of fire to cover. Melvin, get down on the floor over there by the workbench. It'll give you some cover.
Look, guys, I don't want you two putting your asses on the line for me.
We did that the second we took on this case, replied Decker. Now just do what I say, because I hear them coming this way.
They all took up their positions. In the far corners on either side of the overhead garage door, Decker and Milligan knelt down and assumed firing positions, their muzzles aimed at the doorway leading into the house. Mars got down on the floor on the far side of the workbench, keeping his eyes peeled on the same doorway.
Do we wait for them to fire first? Said Milligan.
On the off chance it's some kids exploring, I think we have to wait, said Decker. I'd call out and identify ourselves, but I really don't think it's kids.
Me either.
If you fire, roll to your left. I'll fire next and roll to my right if I can manage it.
Roger that.
The next sound they heard was the door leading into the kitchen slamming shut. Then they heard the lock turn. Then there was a sound of something hard hitting against something else hard.
Decker and Milligan glanced at each other.
I don't like the sound of that, hissed Milligan. What game are they playing?
Hey guys, said Mars softly, do you smell smoke?
Chapter 54. Decker hit the floor leading to the outside and bounced off. He tried the lock. Then he stepped back and fired his gun, shearing the knob off. He tried the door again. It wouldn't budge.
I think it's been jammed or nailed shut, he cried out.
Milligan was attempting to force the garage door up. It's jammed too. The smoke was pouring into the garage from the door leading into the kitchen. Decker and Mars raced over there, coughing and gagging as they did so. Decker's light stabbing through the smoke and darkness.
Decker put his hand against the door and jerked it away with a groan. It's red hot. The fire must be on the other side of the door. We can't get out that way.
Well, there's no other way to get out, yelled Milligan from across the garage.
Mars turned and took off running. He hit the door leading directly to the outside so hard that it broke off its hinges. But bushes and vines had grown up all over the house, blocking the door from falling away. He pushed and kicked, but the door was inextricably tangled up in the heavy shrubs and stout vines and would not give.
Shit, he yelled.
Decker's lungs were heaving. He dropped low to the floor since the smoke was rising. He called out to the others to do the same. He belly crawled over to the overhead door. Milligan was sprawled on his stomach next to it.
Somebody's got to see the fire from the road, gasped Milligan.
But by the time they call the fire department and they get here, we'll be asphyxiated, warned Decker.
Get out of the way, said Mars.
They looked over in time to see him sprinting full speed toward the door.
Both men slid out of the way as he catapulted past them and slammed his shoulder into the overhead garage door. It cracked, but did not give. Mars, gasping for air after having sucked in a huge amount of smoke, dropped to the concrete and was sick to his stomach.
"Someone's trapped us in here," said Milligan. "Set the fire and jam the doors leading out."
Decker knew that he was right about this, but how would someone know they were even coming here? He reached under the bottom of the garage door and heaved upward. The door did not budge. This was an awkward angle for him, preventing him from using most of his strength and none of his bulk to defeat the obstacle. He let go and thought for the first time, "We're going to die in here." The next moment he heard it. Gunshots, just outside. He instinctively rolled to the side, not knowing if the rounds would rip through the door.
"Who's out there?" shouted Milligan.
Something hit the door. Blow after blow rained against it. Then another gunshot. It hit the door near where it met the wall. Decker pushed himself farther back. He readied his gun just in case. But Milligan shot forward, gripped under the bottom of the door, and pushed upward. The door slowly started to rise.
"Help me," he said.
Decker and Mars hurtled forward to assist him. The door moved upward faster.
"Go, go," said Milligan.
He pushed Mars forward. As with the side door to the garage, thick vegetation had grown in front of the garage door. There had been no concrete driveway, only gravel, which had long since been reclaimed by the soil. Mars kicked and thrashed and tore at vines and branches until he was clear of it. Decker was right behind him. As Milligan stumbled out, he got caught between a prickly holly tree and the side of the house. When he cried out, Decker and Mars rushed to his aid, and with their combined strength soon had him free. The three men staggered away from the house and collapsed onto the ground, retching and coughing. Mars rolled over onto his back and looked at his old home. Flames were visible at the front windows. Black smoke was pouring out of fractured glass. Mars lay his head back against the ground and closed his eyes. But Decker was on his feet, looking wildly around. He had heard a car start up, but couldn't see where it was.
"There!" shouted Milligan, who had his gun out and pointed to the left.
The two men reached the road in time to see the taillights of a car disappear into the darkness.
"Shit!" exclaimed Milligan.
He pulled out his phone and tried to make a call, but there was still no cell reception. He shoved it back into his pocket and then raced after Decker, who was already at their car. He jumped in and put the keys in the ignition. It wouldn't start.
"What the hell?" exclaimed Decker.
The car's engine wouldn't even turn over. Decker said,
"Hit the hood release."
Milligan did so, raised the hood, and shone his light around the engine compartment.
"Battery cables," he said.
"They've been cut." Decker got out of the car as Mars walked slowly over to them. The house was fully on fire behind them, but Mars didn't look back. He leaned against the car, his arms folded over his chest, after looking at the severed battery cables.
"I wonder who the hell that was," said Milligan, "in the car."
"That," said Mars, "was my old man." Decker shot him a glance.
"How do you know that?"
Mars pointed to the cut cables. "When I was 17, I rolled the car my dad had given me. It was a piece of crap he got for nothing and fixed up. I was being stupid and going too fast. Luckily, I wasn't hurt. My father brought the car home, repaired it, and when I went out to drive it again, it wouldn't start. I looked under the hood."
"And found the cables cut," said Decker.
Mars nodded. "He said he was teaching me a lesson. If I made a mistake, there were consequences. After working my butt off around the house for 6 months, he replaced the cables." Decker stared after the long-gone car.
"He saved our lives."
"How do you figure?" said Milligan. "I was thinking he almost killed us."
"Someone almost killed us," said Decker, "but it wasn't Roy Mars."
"You sure?" In answer, Decker led them back over to the open garage door, keeping back because of the smoke and flickering flames. He pointed to the right side where the door met the wall of the house.
"You can see that something was jammed in there," he said.
He picked up several pieces of flattened wood that were lying nearby.
"Probably these. Roy pulled these out, although I think he might have shot one out, which accounts for the gunfire we heard by the door. That allowed us to lift the door."
"And the other gunfire?" asked Mars. Your dad was engaged in a gunfight with whoever did try to kill us.
Milligan looked around. You think there might be some bodies around here?
I don't know.
Mars looked at him. So my dad saved our butts?
Yes, he did.
Well, I'm glad he was here today, otherwise we wouldn't be.
Mars looked off in the direction of where his dad had fled.
If he would just come and talk to me, maybe we could work together.
He can't do that, Melvin.
Why not?
Because he's murdered people. If he did come forward, we'd have no other option than to arrest him.
Mars slowly nodded. I guess so.
Don't try to make your father out to be something he's not.
Like what?
I don't think I have to say it, replied Decker. And keep in mind that I'm here to find the truth. And while I know that you're innocent, I also know that your dad isn't. Nothing can change that. Nothing you can do can change that. It is what it is. You have a life to lead. Don't think it's going to be with your dad, because that's not going to happen.
Decker headed toward the road, while Mars stood where he was, looking down at the dirt.
Milligan joined Decker.
I think you were a little harsh back there, Decker.
Why come down on him like a ton of bricks? You think it's better to give him false hope?
You can use some tact.
I don't have any. And Melvin's already lost 20 years of his life. I don't want him to waste another second over a lost cause.
Chapter 55. Bail. Money put up to secure the freedom of a human from incarceration. At least temporarily. The practice had been around nearly as long as there were bars with people put behind them. It was just a way to make money off another's misfortune. There were many businesses built on that concept, and they were all thriving because misfortune was always in abundance. Decker sat at the table in his motel room. The fire at the Mars' old house had been put out, but the place was heavily damaged. The doors in the garage had been jammed shut. And the door leading from the garage into the house had been blocked off by wedging a long metal pipe between the door and the opposite wall. The police had found an accelerant in the kitchen, which meant that the fire had been set deliberately. They had looked for the car seen racing away from the scene, but there had been no sightings. Decker was convinced that Roy Mars was in that car. He had no idea who had set the fire or how they had escaped. Several bullet holes had been found in the exterior walls of the house near the garage. That could have been evidence of a gun battle between Roy Mars and whoever else had been there. More FBI agents had traveled down to Texas to help with the investigation, now that an FBI agent had nearly been killed. What Decker was looking at now were incomplete records. In Charles Montgomery's first arrest in the 1960s, part of the bail record had long since been lost, including who had posted the bail. But in the records of the second arrest, Decker found the name of the person posting bail. Nathan Ryan, he muttered. Ryan had posted bail for Montgomery in Kane, Mississippi on the morning of February 22, 1968. Who was Ryan, and why would he have put up a bond of $500, significant money back then, for Montgomery? Did they know each other? Were they friends? He obviously couldn't ask Montgomery that. He closed his eyes and his mind cast around for a fresh angle from which to pursue the matter. He opened his eyes and also the notebook that lay in front of him. January 11th, 1968, Tuscaloosa, Alabama. DUI and pot possession. February 21st, 1968, Kane, Mississippi. Drunk driving and illegal gun possession. Both states in the South, and both within a short time period. Both involved driving a car under the influence. Was that a theme or pattern, or just the shenanigans of a young, disillusioned former soldier from Vietnam acting out his immense frustrations? He had mustered out in March 1967. So why the approximately 10-month period where he had not been arrested for anything at all? Wasn't it more likely that he would do his petty crime spree right after he'd gotten back? What had happened to him in the intervening 10 months? And after his arrest in Mississippi, it seemed that Montgomery had cleaned up his act, at least until he had started committing far more serious crimes later, culminating in his execution. He closed his eyes again and let his mind wander.
I wonder how many police officers it took to corral Montgomery on those two occasions. Was it one cop car? Two? Four? Six? Only to find the driver drunk? Back then, drunk drivers were treated far more leniently. With a wink and a nudge and a night to sleep it off, with lots of coffee thrown in. That happened even when others were hurt or killed. And Montgomery apparently had hurt no one. Tuscaloosa and Kane, both in 1968. There might be one obvious common denominator. He opened his laptop again, went online, and did another search. January 1968, Tuscaloosa, Alabama. On January 10th, an NAACP office had been bombed. Four people were killed, three civil rights activists and a lawyer from New York, all black. No one had been arrested for the crime. And Charles Montgomery had been there, arrested for DUI and possession of marijuana, and he'd posted bail the next day. He did another search. February 1968, Kane, Mississippi. There were many things that had happened there that month, but one event was predominant and carried the most headlines, and now, the most digital ink. On February 21st, 15 members of an African-American church, including the pastor and four young girls performing in the youth choir, had perished in a bombing. And the next morning, Charles Montgomery had had bail posted for his gun possession and drunk and disorderly charges. Decker couldn't fathom the odds of the man being in the two cities at the same time these bombings were being perpetrated. If it were merely a coincidence, it was the mother of all serendipity. He typed the name Nathan Ryan and added Kane, Mississippi. Then he put in the word bombing and hit the return key. He read through the first few results. When he hit the fifth result, Decker found something that made him focus totally on the screen. It was an obituary of Nathan Bedford Ryan of Kane, Mississippi, who left this life on March 2, 1999. He had been involved in local politics for 37 years, rising to assistant mayor. He had actually died at his desk from a heart attack. That meant he had been on the job when he had bailed out Charles Montgomery, if it was indeed the same Nathan Ryan, and Decker felt sure it was. He looked at the bail report again. The name listed was Nathan B. Ryan. The name on the obituary was Nathan Bedford Ryan, probably after the Confederate general, Nathan Bedford Forrest. As Decker continued reading through the obituary, he stopped on one sentence. The deceased had been one of the first on the scene of the church bombing that had killed 15 people. So that's why Decker's addition of the word bombing had brought this up. Thank you, Google. The articles he had read on the church bombing did not list any survivors, so Decker wasn't sure what, if anything, Ryan had done when he'd arrived on the scene. Perhaps he had just been able to help retrieve bodies. There was a grainy picture of Ryan. He was obviously white. Thus, Decker wondered why Ryan had been so close to a black church that he had been one of the first on the scene. He imagined that in 1968, Kane would have been heavily segregated. So Ryan had posted bail for Montgomery. Ryan worked in the mayor's office. Ryan was one of the first on the scene of the bombing. And $500 for an assistant mayor in Kane in 1968 was not small change. And thus Decker wondered if the source of the funds had actually come from someone else. These events had happened nearly 50 years ago. If Decker traveled to these places, would anyone still be around to talk to him about it? He rose and went in search of Bogart. After giving the FBI agent a thumbnail sketch of what he'd found, Bogart said, "What do you propose doing?" "I propose going to wherever we need to go to solve this," replied Decker. Chapter 56. Decker, Bogart, Jameson, and Mars took a turboprop to Dallas and then a nonstop flight to Memphis. From there, they were going to drive on to Kane in Mississippi. They had left Milligan back in Texas to oversee the search for Davenport and work with the other federal agents on the attack at the Mars' old house. Oliver had some casework to finish up and was to join them later. The drive to Kane took nearly 3 hours.
They had to drive through Tupelo to get there.
Birthplace of Elvis,
said Jameson when they passed the sign for Tupelo. Bogart looked out the window and said dully, "At least it's not raining." When they reached Kane, they drove directly to a police station. Bogart had called ahead, and a middle-aged woman from administration who introduced herself as Wanda Pierce was waiting for them. Pierce was dressed in slacks and a dark green blouse and also wore a nervous expression. She led them to a small conference room with a scarred table and banged-up chairs. The walls were cinderblock painted yellow. They all sat.
"We don't get, many visits from the FBI?"
began Pierce awkwardly. Bogart said, "We appreciate your taking the time to meet with us." Decker said, "Can you tell us more about Nathan Ryan?" She nodded and opened a file she had carried in.
"I've lived in Kane all my life and know some of the Ryans, but when Agent Bogart contacted the department, I looked Ryan up to get some more details. He worked in the local government here for a long time. He died at his desk from a heart attack. This was nearly 20 years ago.
He was the assistant mayor, said Bogart.
That's right.
She looked at Mars.
Wait a minute, aren't you?
He is, said Decker impatiently. Who was the mayor at the time?
I thought you were interested in the assistant mayor,
replied Pierce. I was. Now I'm interested in the mayor.
Why?
Because in my experience, assistant mayors never do anything without their bosses telling them they can. In this case, bail out a drunk named Charles Montgomery.
Oh, well, the mayor at the time went on to become a congressman.
His name?
Thurman Huey.
Bogart said immediately, I know that name. Pierce nodded.
Mr. Huey is the son of Travis Huey, who was a governor of the state, and then went on to the United States Senate in the 1950s and had a very distinguished career.
Bogart said, and Thurman Huey isn't just a congressman. He's the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, arguably the most powerful committee in Congress.
Because it controls the federal government's purse strings,
added Jameson.
Yes,
said Pierce.
And it's rumored that he might be the next Speaker of the House. That would put him number two in line to the presidency,
she added proudly. And Thurman grew up here in Kane?
Born and raised. The Hueys are political royalty in Mississippi, and they've taken good care of us.
Decker said, meaning you get your full share of pork from Washington.
Meaning we get our fair share,
Pierce replied stiffly. And how old is he now? Asked Decker.
I believe he's in his early 70s.
So in 1968, he would have still been in his 20s.
I suppose so, yes.
And he was already the mayor?
Well, his father was a real powerhouse. When his son decided to run, I think it was a foregone conclusion that Thurman would win election. No one was going to buck the old man. His political machine was too strong. Thurman could have won election solely on the Huey name.
About the church bombing? Began Decker, switching gears. Agent Bogart told you we were interested in that, too.
Yes, the Second Freeman's Baptist Church,
said Pierce.
But I don't understand the connection between this Charles Montgomery person having bail posted by Mr. Ryan and the bombing.
Join the club, said Decker. What can you tell us about the bombing?
I wasn't even born when it happened, but it was one of the most horrible events ever to take place here. 15 people, including small children, died. The girls were in the youth choir. I think of them singing their hearts out and then that bomb going off. So terrible.
And they never caught who did it?
No, they never did.
Did they ever have any suspects? Asked Bogart.
I took a look at the files after Agent Bogart made his inquiry. This Montgomery person was never mentioned, if that's what you want to know.
Anyone else?
Well, the KKK was around back then. Threats had been made. Other places in the South had been bombed, including that church in Birmingham in 1963. It was right at the height of the civil rights movements. Lots of bad things were happening. Hell, there were so many explosions in Birmingham, they started calling the place Bombingham.
How was the bombing here accomplished? Asked Decker.
Dynamite. And no one saw anyone place the explosives?
Asked Jameson.
Apparently not.
Decker said, in the information your office earlier provided to Agent Bogart,
It was said that the church was actually under police surveillance because of threats made against the church pastor, who had marched with Martin Luther King Jr. on numerous occasions.
And the pastor had also joined in a lawsuit against the city of Kane and the state of Mississippi for discriminatory acts under the Civil Rights Act.
Yes, that's right.
Decker said, so how could someone plant a bomb large enough to blow up a church and kill 15 people when the police were watching the place and no one sees them? Pierce simply shook her head.
That's anyone's guess.
We need more than a guess, replied Decker.
But it was so long ago, I don't see how you can find a definitive answer now.
Well, in the Birmingham case, they finally prosecuted some of the men for the crime many years after the fact. So maybe we can do the same here. Can you tell us about Thurman's father, Travis Huey?
What about him?
His politics.
He was a good man, did right by the state.
I meant, what was his position on the Civil Rights Act? Pierce frowned.
I have no way of knowing that.
I would assume if he was governor and then the U.S. Senator for Mississippi during the 1950s and beyond, that his politics leaned more toward George Wallace than Hubert Humphrey.
I really couldn't say. I never knew him.
But assuredly, there must have been histories written about such a prominent man.
Look, if you're asking whether Mr. Huey was a racist, I will just say that, based on my limited knowledge, he was a man of his time and a state's rights man.
Decker said, does his son share those views?
This is not the 1950s,
replied Pierce. The problem is, not everyone seems aware of that, said Decker.
If you want to know about Thurman Huey's beliefs, I suggest you take it up directly with him.
In Mr. Montgomery's arrest record, only part of which we've seen, does it note where he was arrested? Pierce looked down at the file and sifted through a few pages.
Yes, it does.
And how close was that location to the church? She seemed to stiffen, as though she had finally connected the dots in her mind.
Well, it actually seems that it was only a few blocks away from the church.
And is it possible that the officers who were guarding the church were also the ones pursuing and then arresting Mr. Montgomery?
I have no way to determine that.
You have the arrest report and the officers' names were surely on it.
Yes, but I don't think there's any way to determine which officers were watching the church at that time.
But it's possible that they were one and the same.
Anything is possible,
she replied sharply. And what was the explanation given at the time as to how the bomb was planted and detonated while the church was supposedly under police protection?
I'm not sure any explanation was ever given because no arrests were made. It seemed that folks assumed whoever did it slipped past the officers somehow.
And the officers' testimony regarding their whereabouts at the time?
There was nothing in the file about that.
But if they did pursue Montgomery and arrest him, that means the church would have been left unguarded, correct?
Accepting your premise, which I don't necessarily, the answer is yes.
And the time of Mr. Montgomery's arrest was 9:10 in the evening?
That's what the files indicate, yes.
And the time of the bombing? Pierce's gaze dropped to the file. Her voice shook slightly when she said,
the best guess was about 9:15.
Interesting coincidence, said Bogart sternly.
Well, don't look at me. As I said, I wasn't even born at the time,
retorted Pierce indignantly. And his obituary said that Nathan Ryan was one of the first on the scene, said Decker.
I read that, too, after Agent Bogart contacted me. I wasn't aware of it before.
But the church was in a predominantly black area. It was nighttime. Why would Ryan have been in the area at all? Did he live close by? Pierce shrugged.
I have no idea. You said you know some of the Ryans?
Asked Jameson.
Yes.
Could you get us their contact information? Said Bogart.
Pierce looked across at Decker with unfriendly eyes.
Are you really suggesting that this Montgomery person was used as a distraction to get the police on guard to leave their posts so the bombing could take place?
No, I'm suggesting that the local police knew exactly what was going on and were ordered to leave their posts to arrest Montgomery so the bomb could be planted and then detonated. She paled.
Ordered by whom?
Well, that's for us to find out, replied Decker.
Chapter 57.
After several phone calls made to various Ryans in town, they arrived at a small, neat bungalow in a modest suburban neighborhood. The houses were shaded with mature trees, and the laughter of children playing filtered through the air. Mildred Ryan was in her late 80s, and wispy white hair covered her pink scalp. Time had bowed her back and shrunk her frame. She wore large black-rimmed glasses that seemed to swallow her tiny face. She sat huddled in a shawl, in a comfortable chair, in a bedroom of the bungalow, which was owned by her daughter. That daughter, Julie Smithers, was eyeing Decker and his group suspiciously as they stood in the doorway of the bedroom.
I really don't see what my mother can tell you. It was a long time ago, and her memory is not that good.
Smithers was short, built like a bulldog, and her face held the same stubborn features of that canine breed. Bogart said smoothly, "We just want to ask a few questions. If she's not up to it, we'll leave and come back another time." Ryan looked up from the Bible she was reading, her finger touching each word.
"Just tell them to come on in, Jules, and ask their questions. I'm up for it,"
she said in a drawl that signaled her Mississippi roots. Decker said, "Doesn't seem to be anything wrong with her hearing."
"Just don't overtire her,"
warned Smithers. She left, and Decker and the others moved slowly into the room. Ryan pointed to two chairs, one of which Jameson took, and the other one Bogart offered to Decker. He sat down and slid the chair closer to Ryan. Bogart and Mars stood behind him. She looked up at all of them.
"Haven't had this many visitors in years," she said.
Bogart showed her his badge and said, "Mrs. Ryan, thank you for meeting with us."
"You're welcome. And what is this about?"
Decker said, "Your husband, Nathan?"
"He's dead, long time ago."
"We know, but we wanted to ask some questions about him. Having to do with the church bombing back in 1968. Do you remember that?" The shrunken woman seemed to collapse inward even more at these words.
"Hell, who could forget? All those little colored children, it was such a shame."
She shook her head.
"It's the devil's work. I said so then, and I say so now."
"We understood that your husband was one of the first on scene of the bombing. That's what his obituary said." She froze for a moment and then looked up at Decker.
"What exactly is all this about?"
"You know that no one was ever arrested for the murders."
"I know that."
"Well, we're here to see if we can find out who did it."
"They're all probably dead."
"Maybe, but maybe not. If they were young back then, they could still be alive. Like you are," he added. She shook her head.
"I don't know anything about that."
"But you might know more than you think," said Bogart. She looked up and suddenly registered on Mars.
"When I said colored just now, I didn't mean any disrespect, just the term we used back then. Should have said African-American or black. I'm sorry, young man."
"That's okay," said Mars.
"It was just different back then,"
mumbled Ryan.
"Just different."
"But maybe you can answer some of our questions," prompted Decker.
"I'm old. I don't remember much. It was a long time ago. I just want to be left alone."
Ryan looked back down at her Bible, her finger moving along the words, her mouth opening as she silently read them. Decker glanced at Jameson, who said,
"Do you read from your Bible every day, Mrs. Ryan?"
Ryan nodded.
"I'm on Deuteronomy, the fifth book of the Hebrew Bible. Do you know it? I find young people don't read the Bible anymore, rather play video games or watch filth on the TV."
"Moses' three sermons to the Israelites,"
replied Jameson. This drew surprised stares from all the men, and Ryan as well. Jameson explained,
"My uncle was a minister. I used to help teach Sunday school. The Israelites were on the plains of Moab. They were about to enter the Promised Land. This was after the 40 years of wanderings, which was explained in the first sermon."
"I'm impressed, child,"
said Ryan.
"Now, if memory serves me correctly,"
continued Jameson,
"the third sermon talks about how if Israel is unfaithful and the loss of their land follows, It can all be made right so long as they repent. I guess that was great comfort to them.
Ryan was staring at her.
Why?
She said in a fierce whisper.
Well, like us, the Israelites were only human. They made mistakes. God understood that. So if they fell down, they had another chance to make it right. So long as they repented. Repented of their sins. Tried to do the right thing. That takes real strength. And real faith.
Jameson fell silent and closely watched Ryan. The old woman slowly closed her Bible, set it on the table next to the bed, clasped her hands in her lap, and said,
What sorts of questions do you folks have?
Decker gave Jameson an appreciative glance and then turned back to Ryan.
Do you know why your husband would have been so close to the church that night, that he was one of the first on the scene after the bombing?
From what we found out, there were houses all around the church, where I'm sure people ran out when the bombing happened. Was he driving by for some reason? Did he tell you about it?
Ryan cleared her throat and took a moment to drink from a glass of water that sat next to her Bible.
Nathan was a good man. I want you to understand that. He was a good man,
she said more emphatically.
I'm sure he was, said Decker.
Mississippi was falling apart back then. Hell, the whole South was, from the 40s to the 60s and on. Riots, lynchings, shootings, things blown or burned up, folks murdered, federal marshals all over the place, the National Guard, coloreds.
She stopped and shot Mars a glance.
I mean, African Americans demanding things from the whites. It all shook us to our souls. That Thurgood Marshall winning all those court cases. Dr. King marching around like Sherman to the sea. Many folks saw it as the apocalypse. Did you see it that way?
Asked Jameson.
I was scared,
she admitted.
The world I knew was turning upside down. Now, don't get me wrong. It didn't surprise me. Hell, if I'd been them, I'd have been demanding the same damn things. But see, I wasn't them, if you can understand that.
She glanced at Mars and then looked away.
And I was raised a certain way and taught things that, thankfully, they don't teach anymore, at least out in the open.
She added with another nervous glance in the direction of Mars. She grew quiet, and no one interrupted the silence. She continued.
Reverend Sidney Houston was the pastor at that church. He could deliver a sermon like no one else, I can tell you that.
How did you know that? Asked Decker. Did you ever attend a service? Her eyes grew wide behind the spectacles.
Oh my goodness, no. I would have been tarred and feathered and run out of town. But you see, Reverend Houston would sometimes take the sermon outside on the front lawn of the church. And his voice carried. It was deep and powerful and, well, some of us would get close enough to hear. The man knew his scriptures and delivered the message forcefully. Made the church I went to seem downright boring by comparison.
Okay, prompted Decker. Ryan started talking faster and with more assurance.
He was a firebrand, that man was. He was taking on Cain like King was doing to Selma, like that Marshall fellow had been doing to every court in the South, and that brought him up against some very powerful people hereabouts.
Do you know who they were? Asked Decker.
Nathan worked in the mayor's office. He was assistant mayor, in fact, at the time.
And the mayor was Thurman Huey, began Decker. She waved her hand dismissively.
The only reason Thurman Huey had that job was because of his daddy. He was barely out of college, still more boy than man. Nathan rightly should have been the mayor. But once Travis Huey spoke, that was that.
Ryan added, the bitterness clear in her tone.
You know, Travis Huey was a hero to many of us back then. We saw him as our protector. And now?
Asked Jameson. Ryan pointed to her Bible.
He was a false prophet spewing evil and hatred and violence,
she added.
Do you think he had anything to do with the church bombing? Asked Decker.
Not Travis Huey. He'd never get his hands dirty.
And his son? Now Ryan seemed to shrink once more. She shook her head.
I don't know one way or another.
What about your husband? She let out a long sigh.
I think Nathan had some inkling. Some.
Her voice trailed off, and she suddenly looked panicked, as though these long-ago memories were surrounding her, and there was no escape from them. He had an idea that something bad was going to happen, suggested Decker. And that was why he was near the church that night? She nodded, almost imperceptibly, her frail shoulders quivering. Jameson reached out and put a comforting hand on the old woman's arm.
Mrs. Ryan, it's okay. I think that your husband was trying to do the right thing.
Ryan sniffled, reached for a tissue, and blew her nose.
He was a good man, but he didn't work with such good people.
Did you know he posted bail for $500 for a man named Charles Montgomery? She rubbed her nose with the tissue.
He told me about that. Money sure didn't come from him. We didn't have that sort of cash to throw around. Certainly not for posting bail for someone we didn't even know.
So he was told to do it and given the money with which to do it?
Yes.
Do you know by whom?
He was assistant mayor. Doesn't take a genius to figure that one out.
So, Thurman Huey?
Maybe his daddy gave him the money, I don't know. Travis was a Dixiecrat,
added Ryan.
And he found good company in Washington. He almost derailed Thurgood Marshall being a Supreme Court justice. Did you know that?
No, I didn't, said Decker.
I didn't follow things like that, but my husband did. He didn't think much of the Hueys. But he lived in Mississippi, and he kept his mouth shut. He went into politics to try to do good. But it was hard to do good in Mississippi back then if it meant doing good for black folks.
That stance probably didn't make him popular, said Bogart.
If you wanted a career in Mississippi back then, you toed the line. He had a family to support, but that doesn't mean he believed what those others did. Because he didn't, I'm sure,
said Jameson.
But he did things, little things, to help folks. He did it under the radar, so to speak.
She looked at Mars.
He helped folks like you, to the extent he could.
Sounds like a man ahead of his time, replied Mars. She nodded.
Old LBJ lost the South when he got the Civil Rights Act passed. Southern Democrats turned their backs on him. Travis Huey sure as hell did. He was furious. Nathan told me.
Decker said, You said that Travis Huey wouldn't get his hands dirty by being involved in the bombing, and you said you didn't know if his son would, but do you think Thurman Huey might have been involved in the bombing? Ryan looked over at her Bible, reached for it, and opened it to where she had been reading. For a few moments, Decker thought she was not going to answer.
I will tell you that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, certainly not with the Hueys.
Decker looked at the others. So you do think Thurman Huey was involved?
I don't know, but I can tell you that Thurman had two very good friends. The Three Musketeers, folks called them back then. They were right famous in town.
Why was that? Asked Bogart.
What else? High school football.
And despite Decker's asking several other questions, those were the last words the woman spoke. Chapter 58. They all sat in the car in front of Smithers' house, staring out the windows. Bogart spoke first. The chairman of the Ways and Means Committee and possibly the next Speaker of the House. I have to admit, I didn't see that one coming. Jameson said,
He was one of the musketeers. I wonder who the other two were.
Decker said, Easy enough to find out.
Where?
Asked Jameson. It was Mars who answered. High school football stars? Why don't we start there? Decker looked at him. We'll make a detective out of you yet, Melvin. Kane High School was smack in the center of town,
They found the school office, made their request, and were quickly shuttled off to the library. There, a young woman in slacks and a sweater greeted them.
The Three Musketeers?
She said in response to their question.
I have heard that. It has to do with...
Football, answered Mars. Back in the 60s. Thurman Huey?
Right, okay. I just started here a few years ago, but I can show you where all the yearbooks are.
They were led to a shelf on which were kept all the yearbooks for the school, dating back to the 1920s. They had already determined Thurman Huey's exact age, so they knew when he probably graduated from high school. Jameson found the right volume, and they gathered around, looking over her shoulder as she slowly turned the pages. Mars saw it first, probably because it was on the pages dedicated to the football team. The Three Musketeers, he said. It was a photo of three young men in football uniforms. The caption below the photo read, Thurman Huey, Danny Eastland, and Roger McClellan, the Three Musketeers. Mars took the book and pointed to the three figures. See how they're lined up? Huey's the QB and the other two are the halfbacks. They're running a version of the Veer offense. Off that, they can run the triple option. We used to do a variation of that at UT sometimes. And that formation came into being during the 1960s, when they were in high school, added Decker. Bogart studied the pictures of the young men. So Danny Eastland and Roger McClellan? Doesn't ring a bell.
Already Googling,
said Jameson. She hit the keys on her phone, waited, and then studied the results.
Let me make sure this is the same Danny Eastland.
She hit a few more keys and the results came up. She read quickly.
Damn.
What? Said Decker.
Danny Eastland has done well for himself. He's the founder and CEO of a government defense contractor. It says here they used to build weaponry, but about 5 years ago moved more to intelligence gathering, which turned out to be a smart move. Last year, it had revenues of more than $5 billion, most of it with the DOD. It's based in Georgia, but there's an office in Jackson, Mississippi, too, among many others. This article says he has a net worth of over $1 billion, and his primary home is in Atlanta.
How about the other musketeer? Asked Bogart. Jameson did a search for Roger McClellan.
Holy shit,
she said when the results came up. The three men looked at her. Well, said Bogart. She looked up at him.
Roger McClellan is the current police chief of Kane, Mississippi.
Decker said, ironic, if he was part of a terrorist act against a church in the very same town. Bogart said, okay, we need to start marching very lightly here. Folks here already know we're making inquiries about the Hueys. And I bet Pierce from the police station has already reported our meeting to McClellan.
And he's probably already contacted Huey and Eastland,
said Jameson. I'm sure he has, agreed Bogart. So we have to be very careful. The last thing we need is to get pulled off the case because the FBI director gets a call from a pissed-off Huey. There's no statute of limitations on murder, Decker pointed out. Granted, but in D.C., Thurman Huey is an 800-pound gorilla.
Wait a minute,
said Jameson.
Do you think they're the ones who kidnapped Davenport? That would make it a very recent crime.
Bogart shook his head. I can't believe Thurman Huey would be involved in something like that. Decker said, if Roy Mars has evidence that Huey was involved in the church bombing, and that evidence comes to light, Huey won't just lose his career. He could very well end up in prison for the rest of his life. Given that, I think the man might be capable of anything. Mars said, what sort of evidence would my dad have? Whatever was in the safe deposit box, said Decker. In a shaky voice, Mars said, you think he was involved in the bombings? I don't know, Melvin, but somehow he ended up with something that will bury some very powerful men. No wonder he went on the run and changed his name. Mars tried to say something, but nothing came out. He finally just shook his head. Decker returned the book to the shelf while the others headed to the door. He had a sudden thought, opened the yearbook to a certain page, scanned down it, and then ripped